Great. Thank you very much for the introduction and the invitation to come back to Santa Barbara. I was here about a month ago as part of the workshop. It was really wonderful, and really hated to be back in Philadelphia, so I had to come back one more time. And I will be talking about collective variable enhanced biomolecular simulation, so I hope I can give you a little bit of an idea what that means. Those of you who saw me give a chalk talk here about a month ago, I'm not going to be talking about what I talked about then. So if that makes you unhappy, then I'm sorry. So I'll motivate what I do first by giving you the generic picture of molecular dynamics and why MD is not good enough for the kind of things I want to study. I don't think I need to go through much detail about what this equation says. It's just the standard Langevin equation in MD with an interatomic force field, and we have friction and noise. And of course, if we want to push a system around using MD and see anything interesting happen, especially if it's a large biomolecular system like a protein, we typically can't do that. This is an example of one that I just started working on. This is the HIV matrix protein. It's an interesting protein because it's the multiple copies of it assembled together like Lego blocks to build the bud of a virus as it comes off of an infected cell. So learning how they lock together is an important thing to study. And what I'm showing you here is just a quick little movie, 1 nanosecond long, of MD. And there's a particular variable that I'm tracking, calling that theta of x. It's really just the distance between two parts of the protein, and it doesn't really move at all on the nanosecond time scale. So to see something interesting happen to that variable using straightforward MD is, of course, not feasible. And MA, the matrix protein, is interesting not only because it builds a scaffold of an HIV particle, but also because it interacts with a lot of host proteins as well. And in order for it to do that, it has to expose these residues on the inside of it, in terms of this structure, which we simply can't see with MD. So this variable, for example, in order to see something interesting happen with this variable, we would have to acquire values about this large. So I can create states like this artificially, but of course to see them happen naturally under MD is impossible. So MD alone is simply not good enough at broadly sampling collective variables. So there are lots of ways to attack this problem of poor sampling and collective variables in MD, and the approach that I've taken recently has been using temperature accelerated MD. Now, Mark Tuckerman presented this under a different name before, sort of similar idea. I forget what he called it now. it had more letters than this. So we call it temperature acceleration, and when I say we, I mean Eric Vandenheide and myself call it that, but I certainly didn't come up with it. This was the work of Luca Margliano. Anyway, so what you want to start with temperature acceleration is to think about the interatomic potential being augmented, or the atomic variables X being augmented with some additional variable Z. And these variables Z act as set points for collective variables. So theta sub J represents some function of the atomic coordinates, anything you want, the distance between two centers of mass, a torsion angle, whatever, anything that you can express as a function of atomic coordinates. And so this term and this extended potential is just a harmonic coupling between these set points and these reporter functions or collective variables. Okay, so if I were to plug this into a Langevin equation and write down the resulting equation of motion for the atomistic variables, this is what it would look like. This is the exact same equation I showed you before in the previous slide, with the addition of that term there. That's just the spring forces, if you like, that couple the collective variables to these desired set point values. And of course, you have a Jacobian there to take care of the mapping back to the atoms. So kappa plays the role of a spring constant here. So I could stop here and say this is all you need to do things like free energy calculations, for example, thermodynamic integration, where one could run MD on a system where you've set the values of Z, some point in Z space, run the simulation and accumulate statistics on this force. All right. And what that would tell you, of course, is that when you're holding a system at a fixed point in Z space, the force is telling you which way the system would want to go if you let go of it. And that's a measure of that is the gradient, the local gradient in free energy. And so if you do multiple simulations at multiple points in Z space, you can map out the gradients in a free energy and then reassemble it using some kind of numerical integration approach. And in one dimension, that's typically called thermodynamic integration. And you can get a potential mean force out that way. So it's a way to get statistics on collective variables. Now the insight, or the sort of wrinkle, if you like, and temperature acceleration is to let these set point values themselves be dynamical variables, so they can move. Okay, so they obey some equation of motion, and in this case, I'm showing you an overdamped dynamics, where, again, if we make these variables evolve, and this is the equation of motion in the case of overdamped that arises from this potential. And what we see is that we have forces that are sort of the opposite of the forces that go to the atoms. So now the really key insight in temperature acceleration is then to say, look, if, again, akin to what Mark Tuckerman was saying before, if we work in a situation where these z variables now are allowed to evolve very, very slowly, so that these instantaneous gradients that are acting on them in some sense average, then you get what's actually being communicated to those variables is a gradient in free energy. So we want to really tune down the rate at which these z variables evolve by taking this artificial friction, gamma bar, to be much, much larger than the friction that's in the thermostat of the atomistic system. And that should guarantee that the z's move slowly, and as they're moving slowly, the thetas are sloshing back and forth, and that gives them statistics on the gradients in free energy. And this can work in not just one dimension, but a high-dimensional collective variable space. So this paper, so the culmination or the climax, if you like, of this paper is to show that when you take appropriate limits, that this equation of motion ends up looking like this, where the z's now evolve in response to gradients in a free energy. That free energy is being computed by the atomistic system at the temperature of the atomistic system. The acceleration comes in when we make the noise that acts on the z variables of a higher temperature. So these guys can be made to move slowly, but in response, they can move over free energy barriers much more easily than they would otherwise by taking this temperature large. Okay. So this is a very generic sort of picture of how temperature acceleration works. And of course, I haven't said anything about what these collective variables are and then what is this actually good for. I'll skip that. So I'll give you a couple of examples of where we've used temperature acceleration to do conformational sampling in large proteins. So what you're looking at here are two crystal structures of Groeyel chaperonin. So if I had an extra half hour, I could tell you all that's interesting about Groeyel chaperonin, why it's a fascinating molecule. But for the purposes of this talk, all I want to use it for is a test bed as an example of a protein that undergoes very large-scale conformational changes. So what you're looking at on the left here is the so-called T-state of the Groeyel homotetradecamer. That means it has 14 subunits. They're all the same protein, and they're arranged in 2 7-membered rings back to back. And I've highlighted one of the 7 members in this upper ring by coloring it according, well, rendering it as a ribbon diagram and then coloring it according to domains. So this is a protein that's roughly 600 amino acids long. There's an equatorial domain, an intermediate domain, and an apical domain. Now on the right-hand side, you're seeing the exact same protein in a different state, the so-called R double prime state. To be more specific, the upper ring is in the R double prime state, the bottom ring is still in the T state, and the upper ring is also bound to another protein called GroES. So the conformational change that GroEL undergoes essentially involves the apical domain lifting up by about 60 degrees and rotating by about 90 degrees to present a couple of helices worth of binding surface to engage the GroES co-chaperonin. So this is an example of a protein that undergoes a fairly large-scale conformational change. It's large in the sense that the distance by which this apical domain moves is larger than its own size, according to this conformational change here. Now, what we wanted to do, the real challenge in conformational sampling in proteins, is to run some kind of simulation where one can start with this state and have it, without knowing the other state exists, have it visit that other state. All right. Other people have studied this actual protein using other methods whereby you can put in this state as a target and actually drive this state to that state. What I'm talking about is a blind search where we start with this and see if we actually visit that. And so this is an example of that. So what we did was we coarse-grained, or we invented some collective variables on the Groeyel subunit. We took a single subunit, put it in a box full of water, and counterions. It's about 120,000 atoms. And this is a stylized rendering of that simulation. And what you're looking at is the protein itself. There's an ATP molecule bound here. The gray sort of skeleton is the R double prime conformation that's been aligned on the equatorial domain with the actual protein that we'll be pushing around, and that's the colored one here. And what we see is in this particular case where we've taken collective variables that are centers of mass of groupings of atoms in this protein, there's 9 centers, so there's 27 collective variables. We run this under TAMMed for about 40 nanoseconds at about 10 times thermal energy. So we give the collected variables 10 times thermal energy. We see it spontaneously visit in a couple of instances very close to the R double prime state. And what you'll notice during this simulation is that the protein is not unfolding, the helices are remaining intact, the domain structures themselves actually aren't changing at all, they're just moving relative to one another along the flexible hinges in the molecule. And it's hard to see exactly when it overlaps, but it overlaps in a couple of places. Okay, so this was a nice demonstration that one can do large-scale conformational sampling with an approach like this and actually see states that are crystallographically relevant without putting that information into the simulation. Okay, so since then we've looked at several other systems using TAM, and I want to highlight a couple of them now. And this is a paper that just came out. We actually got together with Luca and one of my students to study this particular protein. So this is the insulin receptor kinase. Let me first tell you a little bit about the structure of insulin receptor. So insulin receptor is a very large protein. It's a couple of thousand residues long. It's dimeric. It has two basic parts. There's the part that sticks outside the cell that recognizes insulin. There's the part that's inside the cell. Those are kinase modules, like the one I'm showing here. The job of the insulin receptor is to turn on when insulin binds. So when insulin binds to the outside, something happens to turn on then the kinase modules on the inside to make them catalytically active. And their job is to transfer phosphate groups from ATP to substrate proteins. And that initiates a cascade, a set of signaling events that ultimately leads a cell, if enough insulin receptors are activated, to start taking in glucose. So what we wanted to study was the transition of the kinase module of the receptor going from the inactive form to the active form. And kinases are a large class of proteins, and there are a lot of drugs in development to either interfere or enhance kinase activity. And so it is a class of proteins that's been studied quite a bit, but no one has studied with this level of detail yet the insulin receptor kinase. So I want to highlight for you a couple of features of the inactive and active forms of this protein before I talk about some enhanced sampling we did with it. So the important bit, first of all, is this A loop here. It's a couple dozen residues long, and there is this phenylalanine, this little purple guy. And in the inactive form, he's in the wrong place. So I've colored in a bunch of residues green. That's known as the C-spine. And when that phenylalanine is right there in the C-spine, sticking in like a knife, it's occupying the binding site for ATP. So this is an inactive form of the kinase. And these orange guys are the so-called R-spine, or regulatory spine. And in the active form of the kinase, that phenylalanine should be sitting right there in the R-spines, actually making this one continuous grouping of side chains. Held in this configuration, this is the sort of defining property of the active form of the kinase, because now the C-spine is broken and ATP can bind and initiate a catalysis. There's also a little aspartate group here. That's a negatively charged side chain that flips into a position when the phenylalanine flips out, and that flipping into position puts it into position to actually chelate part of an ATP molecule, which I'm not showing here. So this flip of the phenylalanine and the aspartate is an important part of the mechanism of activation of kinase. It's called DFG flip. And we wanted to see if we could study this or actually see whether it happens if we start with this structure and run TAMed where we've only accelerated the A loop. Do we actually see spontaneous creation or destruction of the C-spine and creation of the R-spine? I'm new with these things, so I keep wanting to reach for the computer to flip the slide. Here we go. Okay. So what I'm showing on the left is some data taken from a TAM simulation where I'm measuring the RMSD of this A loop with respect to the active form initiated from the inactive form. So initially we're very far from the active form. We run about 40 nanoseconds of TAM, again with a 6 kcal per mole. And we have five centers of mass that we're accelerating along that A loop. And we see that after a little bit of time, we start going down toward the active form. This is spontaneously. It's not being pushed. It's not being attracted there. It's just going there on its own. Little inset here showing you the RMSD relative to the R spine of the active form crystal structure, and there's a quick jump down into the active form where we see the phenylalanine being spontaneously inserted into the R spine. So these are some snapshots along one particular trajectory that show the flip. It's hard to tell, but the flip actually occurs right there. It's flipped into the R spine, and then the R spine clamps down on it in the rest of the simulation. The important thing I wanted to point out, though, that we thought was interesting in this particular transition is that it's characterized, or it has as part of it, transient folding about 2.5 turns worth of alpha helix in the A loop. that seems to serve to pull the phenylalanine out of this pocket and flip it, and then that helix unfolds and flips it into the R-spine. So the question that naturally arose here was that since we're doing enhanced sampling with CAMD, we don't have a reason to expect a priori that these intermediates are relevant, right? We're accelerating this molecule, we're exploring the free energy surface with CAMD, but we might not be in physically relevant parts of free energy space here because we've given it so much thermal energy. We just don't know until we actually try and measure the free energy. So the point was, we don't know whether this particular mechanism where there's a transient folding of an alpha helix is actually what happens in the lowest free energy pathway of this transition. So that's what we set out to do, was to take the TAMD initial set of images that came out of a TAMD simulation, treat them as a discretized path in Z space that takes us from the active form to the inactive, or from the inactive form to the active form, and then refine that initial path to a minimum free energy path to see if this helix survived and other things. And so that's what we did. The method we use there is string method. So string method does just what I said. This is not for the kinase. This is a figure I stole out of one of Eric's papers for alanine dipeptide. But the basic idea in string method is that you have a discretized string that spans collective variable space, and each point on that string is an MD image, an MD system, okay? And the basic idea is that you run TAMD on those points and let them fall down gradients in free energy, because TAMD, of course, can measure those gradients and have the system respond. But you also put in some fancy forces to keep the images from collapsing onto one another. So you maintain a constant parameterization of the string as well. And that way, you can literally imagine a string that these contours represent free energy, contours in free energy for this particular set of collective variables. And you can imagine the beginning with this string here, it just simply rolls down and finds this now pathway of minimum free energy between these two stable states. So we used string method on the insulin receptor kinase. Well, the first thing we did before we did string method is we asked how bad are the thermodynamics of our initial pathway taken from TAMD. So we harvested, I believe, 22 images from the inactive form to the active form taken from a TAMD trajectory, all right? And then we called that our initial string, froze them in Z space, ran long MD simulations with each one, computed the mean forces on each one, and then took the tangential component of each of those forces along that string, thermodynamically integrated that, or numerically integrated that, to get a potential of mean force going from the inactive form to the active form. So you can see clearly here, and to go to the active, what we call putative active form, is an incredibly large amount of free energy that has to be paid to do that. So we clearly would argue this is not thermodynamically feasible in reality. We've actually done something to make the system go pretty far from where it should be, at least as measured by the energy. So we run string method for about 12 iterations or so, and what we find is that it converges to this path here, or this PMF here, which is much more reasonable. It's actually showing that in this particular model, that the active form has a very slightly metastable basin compared to the inactive form. And I should point out that our all-atom model of the kinase is missing the phosphate groups that would be on the tyrosines that are on the activation loop itself to make it more soluble. That would probably bring this down to a really stable basin, but we don't have a convenient way to put that chemistry into the model just yet. But nevertheless, we're able to see this convergence to a reasonable PMF. And so and the nice thing about this is that for this converged string, when we let the system evolve, the helix remains robust. So part of this minimum free energy path for flipping the phenylene out of the C-spine into the R-spine, the phenylalanine, is that we see a transient fold of a helix that pulls the phenylene out, and then it unfolds and flips it into place. Okay. So that was an example where I think what I was happy to see is that the basic mechanism that we observed happening under the TAMD simulation was robust under string method. And then what we wanted to do with a different student this time is study another protein that has some biomedical relevance, this time with just purely the string method. And this is beta-2 microglobulin. So the reason why beta-2 microglobulin is biomedically relevant is that it's amyloidogenic. It can form plaques. And it's originally, beta-2 is part of the major histocompatibility complex. And in diabetic patients, it can't dialyze out of blood, so it builds up. in the particular places it likes to build up most is in the synovial fluid of the knee joint. And so a lot of diabetic patients suffer from what's known as dialysis-related amyloidogenesis, which is basically plaques that form in the knees. And this particular protein is at the heart of that. And it's been studied both using NMR and crystallography to get out some structures. And there's recently there was published a study that claims to have identified the amyloidogenic form of this protein. So what you're looking at here is an overlay of two NMR-derived structures of beta-2 microglobulin. The black one is in the non-amyloidogenic form. The red one is the putative amyloidogenic form, the one that likes to self-aggregate. And the key distinction between the two is there's a particular loop. I mean, if you study protein science at all, you recognize this as the quintessential immunoglobulin fold of a protein. So it's a couple of beta sandwiches or beta sheets stuck together. One of the loops in this fold has a proline. And prolines are notorious for making the backbone of a protein somewhat less flexible than it would otherwise like to be. And the quintessential feature that discriminates between amyloidogenic and healthy and amyloidogenic form, that this proline side chain flips from one pocket to another. And that actually happens when the peptide bond immediately upstream of that proline switches, isomerizes from cis to trans. So that's actually a somewhat rare event in biology, that the cis-trans isomerization happens in a peptide bond, but it happens upstream of prolines a little more frequently than others. Okay, so one of the important details about this red structure is that the red structure is actually not beta-2 microglobulin. It's a mutant, and they had to mutate it. The authors of the study had to mutate it because true full-length beta-2 in the amyloidogenic form as a monomer is not observable. Is too short-lived. So they mutated it to make it long-lived, and they got a structure. So what we decided to do was to undo that mutation computationally and look at a particular hypothesis for what makes this more stable state in the amyloidogenic form. The key in that hypothesis is that it's observed that low pH tends to make this amyloid grow faster. And so we speculated that there are some histidine residues which will undergo a change of charge. They can be protonated at low pH, and these charged histidines might be responsible for the enhanced amyloidogenicity of this protein. So what we were able to do was build, what we decided to do was run on-the-fly string method. So what on-the-fly means is that instead of running string method in iterations, we run concurrently all the images together in lockstep. And we allow them to evolve with the MD simulations at the same time, very much like TAM does for a single image. We do it for all images together. So we built a system of 27 replicas laid out on a 3x3x3 cube. So each one of these is a replica of beta-2 microglobulin. And the zigzag white line sort of indicates the registry of images along the string, along the pathway and collective variable space. So here is, back in the background here, that's the amyloidogenic conformation, and up here is the native conformation. And so what we can do now is, this is in a great big box full of solvent, it's about 700,000 atoms or so. We can run this concurrently where we allow the string to evolve to a pathway of minimum free energy. The actual collective variable space we work in included the dihedral angle at the proline 32 and another 20 relevant inter-alpha carbon distances that were able to discriminate between the active form, I mean the native form and the amyloidogenic form. Okay. And so we converged the string for both unprotonated and protonated histidine residues in this protein. And the first thing we did after we converged those strings was to measure the free energy along the paths. And the blue curve here is the protonated potential of being force, and the red is the protonated potential of being force. And over here we have the healthy form of the protein, and out here we have the amyloidogenic form. So the first thing we notice is for the blue curve is that in order to go from healthy to amyloidogenic, there's a fairly large free energy barrier that has to be crossed. And the amyloidogenic form is in the non-protonated case is not particularly stable. So we wouldn't expect to see this state significantly populated under physiological conditions when those histidines are neutral. In the case of the protonated histidine residues, we see a much different case where the barrier to get over this to form the amyloidogenic form is much lower, 10 or 12 kcals per mole. And this amyloidogenic form is actually much more stable. So we would expect to see this state populated enough to begin the formation of amyloid plaques under physiological conditions, under conditions where both those histidines are protonated. I should point out that we're in the right ballpark when it comes to these barriers. The activation energy for flipping a bare prolyl cis-trans prolyl cis-trans isomerization is about 20 kcals per mole. So we're actually somewhat lower than that, which is possibly indicative of the fact that this protein can auto-catalyze this particular transition. So I'll just show you some snapshots from the pathways here. The top row are a bunch of side views that essentially show you that we're flipping the proline from the one pocket to another. You can't see the pockets in this view because the only space-filling part of that protein that I'm choosing to render is the proline itself. But you can see the individual strands here. And so this is the transition state according to that free energy profile. These are the same configurations viewed from the top where I rendered all the atoms in van der Waals. And these little insets here indicate this is the cis peptide bond between proline 32 and its upstream neighbor. The transition state, it's about 90 degrees, and in the final state, it's 180 degrees. So it's gone from cis to trans along this pathway. There's the proline sitting right there, very happily tucked into a hydrophobic pocket that involves the two histidine residues on either side of it. In this case, when we force it to flip out of that pocket into the neighboring pocket, we've voided the region between these two histidine residues, and they are unhappy to do that because they are hydrophobic when they're unprotonated. So we've actually created a big void in the protein surface where we've moved that proline out of the way that is the source of this high free energy penalty and the instability, in fact, of this particular state. So we wouldn't expect this to exist in nature, and we can now explain why based on the structure. Okay, so in the case of the protonated pathway, the top part looks basically the same, except for if you remember some details, part of this pocket was really closer in the unprotonated case than it is now. Nevertheless, you see basically the same picture. The proline is able to flip into the from one pocket into the other. If we look down from the top, here's the proline, and now the histidines are protonated, and this guy, the histidine is pretty far away. The pocket itself is actually much less well structured when both histidines are protonated. And then when the proline flips out, what comes to the rescue and prevents these two histidines from clashing is an aspartate. And that aspartate actually likes to stick in the final case, in the final state, it likes to stick electrostatically to the histidine. And that favorable interaction is responsible, or partially responsible at least, for the stabilization of this state. And now the proline is in a little happy hydrophobic pocket over here, and this state is very, very stable. So this is the amyloidogenic form of the peptide. We're able to show that we see sort of the right thermodynamics for this process when we include undo all the mutations that were done in the experimental structure. Okay, so that's about it for my talk, and I'll just say that I hope that I've shown you two different methods for doing collective variable enhanced simulations. And temperature acceleration is basically good for doing enhanced conformational exploration and generation of initial paths. It doesn't give you the right statistics on those conformations, so it's important that once you have an initial path, you do careful free energy calculations to characterize them thermodynamically. And that was the role in this particular case of string method, where I took the initial paths that are generated using TAMD and was able to converge them to MFEPs and then look at the energetics and the mechanism of the conformational transitions along those pathways. And so what I'll do now is acknowledge Eric, of course, for working with me and getting this stuff working, and funding from NSF, NIH, and a hefty TerraGrid allocation for doing most of the computations. So I'm about a minute ahead. So I'm done.
The free energy curves you are showing looked a bit noisy. Is there an estimate of uncertainties that you can get, and how can you get that systematically?
My student and I talked about this, and essentially each one of these is, yes, you can. The answer is that you can, and I'm not showing them here. The error bars are actually pretty small in these measurements. Each one of these represent, okay, so you have to compute forces, okay? And the forces are accumulated, and so what you really want to do is get at how I guess the only way to do it would be to run multiple replicas of the same system and get samples of it. We didn't actually do that. Yeah, we didn't get independent samples of that. We looked at the sort of, when you look at the accumulation of forces, you can take like the last, say, 100 picoseconds of that and then look at the scatter there, and that was well below even the resolution of these points. So.
How reasonable is it to equate energy paths with real kinetic pathways, these kinds of systems?
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that until you know rates, right? And so one would have to measure rates of going from state A to state B and then decide whether the minimum free energy path represents sort of the middle of a tube of high probability flux between, you know, going from A to B. In one sense, I think the MFEP is giving you a picture of the, you know, order in which things can occur. It doesn't necessarily mean that that is always how they occur, but it gives you a plausible starting point. And really what experimental collaborators are looking at when they look at this is, okay, are there new ideas here that we can test mutagenically? And so, for example, in this particular case, even though it might not be the actual mechanism, at least now they have a good basis to test, for example, whether, ASP34, which has never been tested before, is relevant for this particular transition. So, in some sense, to truly get at whether an MFEP represents the mechanism of a reaction, you need to do a rate calculation to show that of possible alternatives, the one that has the highest rate is the one that's going to happen the most. But that's in the future. We haven't done that yet.
So actually, on that previous slide you had up there. So can you say something about how much computational effort you have to do for each point, and how do you know you're getting enough sampling? And then more generally, you know, you can kind of see how this particular problem, you know, what was kind of needed physically. But in general, you know, what are the limits where the method is going to run into sampling issues?
We always worry about sampling. We decided this was good enough basically because we allow the strings to evolve until the collective variables are no longer changing appreciably. That's sort of a judgment call. So you could probably, if the system has become stiff and maybe we don't see the changes, then obviously we run against the sampling error. We're looking at a different system now where that's definitely the case. This is a relatively small protein, so we were pretty sure that we weren't running into that case. In terms of the amount of effort involved here, evolving the string we were running on a GPU cluster with, in this case, 16 nodes and 6 GPUs per node or something like this. It took about a week or so. Once we realized all the mistakes we were making, a week of good production gave us one string. And then it takes another week to do the force accumulation to get the potentials of mean force. Okay, so it's not that intensive for a system of this size. We're looking at a system that's an order of magnitude larger right now, and it's proving much, much more difficult. I think I was hitting at all your questions there. Several of them. Did I miss one? Okay.
It is remarkable the size that you can already do. But one of the things that always puzzles me about these particular kinds of free energy profiles is that if you look in the equations, it's the work to move, you know, you have 27 variables in this space that you're still keeping. And the free energy profile that we see is the work to move along a path in mm-hmm. that 27-dimensional space.
Reversible work.
So, you know, how do you envision eventually converting this kind of free energy to the kind of free energy that we need to do the rate calculation where you only have the 1 degree of freedom left?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I don't, because it's my understanding is to do the rate calculation on the free energy, you need the free energy as a function. You need the free energy field, right? You need the full field of free energy. We're getting it along one string. So in some sense, you don't really need it if it's a good enough guide. If the MFEP is a good enough guide, and if it's everywhere perpendicular to dividing surfaces that you can do a milestoning calculation with, then once you have that MFEP and you foliate your space, it doesn't matter where you got it from, right? But that's, at the end, the only way you're going to be confident in that rate is if it is correctly, if it matches experimental rates, right? That comes down to the dimensionality of collective variable space. In three-dimensional collective variable space, for example, it would be easy, relatively more easy, because using what's called the single sweep method, which is something that Mark Tuckerman also presented a little bit earlier today, we can reconstruct full three-dimensional free energies and then do rate calculations on them, you know, diffusion equation calculations on them. But here, 20. This is actually 25 collective variables. 21 collective variables. There's not much of a chance to do using this profile to do a rate calculation. I mean, I wouldn't want to do that. Yeah, I just would want to do milestoning. Once I've forgotten about this, I would just do milestoning and be done with it.
Yeah. I have a conceptual question. So if you use your accelerated method to evolve your string, don't you only explore the configurational space which corresponds to your accelerated approach?
Oh yeah, no, it's I spoke a little too quickly. The equation you let z's obey in string method, if you use a so-called zero temperature string method, is this equation where you let actually t bar be zero. All right, so it's really sort of a steep descent. Right, but then you always the z's evolve by steepest descent according to this equation, but what's missing here would be the term that reparameterizes the z's along the string, so that would be part of this as well. And I didn't want to throw more equations at you, but yeah, you can run finite temperature string method as well, where you let, and we've done that, where you let t bar be something larger in the hopes of letting the string equilibrate more quickly, it would go over little, you know, KT size barriers a little more quickly. We haven't seen that to be a particular advantage. But at the end, the only thing, what you have to do to convince yourself the string method has converged is run it until the z's stop changing. That's really the only thing we can do. And when they stop changing, we have to throw our hands up and then start measuring the free energy. We have one over here and one over here. Whoever gets the microphone first.
Right, Kevin,
oh, here we go, Marcus.
From
okay.
At least from the pictures that you showed, the two free energy minima that were competing against each other both look like enthalpic minima. Do you envision any bigger complications if one of them is an enthalpy and the other one's an entropy-dominated minimum? So that one of them
yeah.
is like really
oh,
big
yeah.
configurations.
That would mean I've done a poor choice picking collective variables, right? Because I'm gonna have to have a lot of sampling in one part of CV space, and it's okay if I don't have very much in the other. And so in this case, you're right. It's basically enthalpic because the leading contribution to this transition is flipping this peptide bond from cis to trans, and that's almost all enthalpic. But what puts fuzz on either side of it is the fact that the protein rearranges itself around, or the residues can rearrange themselves around that important proline side chain. So there is a little bit of entropy involved.
One might be interested in, say, just a folding transition where the folded state is.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what do you do then? Can you treat these?
I would not use string method. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't looked so much at that yet. I mean, I've done a little bit, I've done a few calculations that ended up not being published. And if you saw me talk at the von Neumann seminar, yeah, you saw me talk about polyalanine folding with TAMMed. That doesn't work. I can say that doesn't work.
Question about the TAMD method itself. The proof that the collective variables move according to the lower temperature free energy surface
mm-hmm.
Assumes a limit in which I guess the collective variables are moving infinitely slowly.
Correct.
So they don't get around very fast. Okay.
Correct.
So that, but you obviously don't want that. So
no.
By letting your collective coordinates actually move, there must be sort of a trade-off between the accuracy of the surface on
mm-hmm.
which they're moving and how far you actually get. Do you have the rule of thumb or something that tells you how to choose this parameter? What is it?
There's a couple of parameters. I mean, there's three parameters that are really important here: gamma bar, T bar, and kappa. Okay, kappa, you know, sort of by itself determines the accuracy, how close this what we work with is a mollified free energy, because this really these you put this into the partition function, these should be delta functions. But as Mark pointed out before, these are actually Gaussians in the partition function. So kappa determines the accuracy. Gamma bar determines how adiabatically decoupled you are. So in Mark's work, that was mass. Here we use friction. It's sort of irrelevant which one you use. What we measure is actually a quantity. We look at just the fluctuation. So this defines a length scale, right, on which if we see fluctuations like this at the physical temperature, then we know we're adiabatically decoupled. If we see fluctuations like that, we know that the Z's are actually governing the fluctuation. So what we really want to see is this. So we can measure the degree at which this adiabatically decoupled by looking at that parameter. And again, you're never there unless gamma bar is infinite. So you're always going to have some coupling that's not adiabatic, I guess. And so there's not really a good rule of thumb. We were working with mixtures of about 50% to get the GROW-EL to work, to run on reasonable time. And all we wanted to do was exploration. So I don't really care if it's not perfectly accurate on the free energy surface. Exploration was the name of the game. If you want to get the free energies back, you have to do something more careful, which is why we moved to string method calculations to actually characterize transitions, or say the free energy of two well-defined states. So string method is pretty much the method of choice when you have high dimensional collective variable spaces. So if TAMD is giving you the idea that there's a state there, then string method can be used to do the careful thermodynamic characterization or comparison between the two states.
Are you likely to go over too high a barrier if your gamma bar is too small? If you're not moving on the right surface, you might just...
Yeah, I mean, if gamma bar is too small, then this term, let's see, if gamma bar is too small, well, obviously in the update equation for this, you divide through by gamma bar. So this guy's proportional to 1 over root gamma bar, and this guy's proportional to 1 over gamma bar. So if gamma bar is too small, your noise is going to dominate. The same as it would be somewhat the same as making the temperature too high. You make T bar too high, you ignore this information, right? And those are the free energy gradients. So you can clearly make the system go anywhere you want by tuning up the temperature, tuning down the gamma. So yeah, rules of thumb, 10 times thermal energy is reasonable in a lot of cases, so it's what we use here. And we use gamma bar anywhere. We basically look at this parameter and decide whether or not we think gamma bar is big enough, right? And a lot of it depends on the actual collective variables you've chosen. If you choose collective variables thinking that they should not result in unfolding the protein, but of just moving domains relative to one another, if you see domains unfolding, that probably means you were too aggressive. You need to dial it back. We saw that quite a bit. If you pick collective variables that you do want to unfold the protein and you don't see it, then you need to turn it up. So there's a lot of art still in here. Yeah.
Quick follow-up on that. Why doesn't gamma bar have a J-index? I mean, I would think different collective variables would have different friction coefficients.
We have never done that, but they certainly could. There's no reason why not. Yeah. Yeah. We've just never used it. Different. That's. I didn't want to open up yet another dimension and parameter space for my students to investigate, I guess. But yeah, they certainly could. And the cap, for that matter, the kappas do. In fact, we do. I could go into any level of detail you want about this, the beta 2 calculations we did. This collective variable here is, the dihedral angle is not the same dimension as the distances. So the kappa even has a different meaning. We had different values of kappa in that case. So there were CV specific values of these parameters. Yeah.
So do you have any rules a priori to decide what is a good collective variable? You always talked about collective variables, and when you said this one turns out to be not good, this one turns out to be good.
Case,
is there anything you can say ahead and say, I have to construct them in that way so that I can be sure that I or have a good chance at certain phenomena?
It's a good question. So it's still it's based on intuition. We're still basically the Wild West when it comes to picking collective variables. In this case, for this protein, the rule of thumb we used was that I had to capture the transition of the proline going from cis to trans. I had to resolve that. That had to be one of the variables. And the other was that I wanted internal measurements that were not referenced to a global coordinate frame. This is the first case I wanted to do that, where we basically compared these two states. These are thermodynamically well-characterized states. Measures that are different between those two states, so state-sensitive measures, and those happen to be a handful. If we looked at all possible alpha carbon and alpha carbon distances, and we had a rule for down-selecting that set to a set of about 20 that are the most important for determining the two states. So if you can basically statistically infer which state you're in based on those two sets of collective variables. And then we just ran with that, and it seemed to work okay. In other cases, that doesn't work. I mean, you can pick inner alpha carbon distances that are the same value in two very different states, but they go through, they can go through some kind of transition that we would never capture. So there's still a lot to be done in terms of picking the right collective variables, but we are essentially using physical intuition at this point. Yeah, I mean, we knew in this point that we wanted to measure the thermodynamics of that transition, so we had to make sure it was part of the variables. Yeah.
Thank you, Cameron.
Thank you.